Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
I'm Charlotte Metcalfe, and my guest today is the writer and naturalist Helen MacDonald. Helen soared to fame in 2014 with the publication of their multiple award-winning best-selling book, H is for Hawk, which describes the year Helen's beloved father's unexpected death in 2007, during which Helen bought and trained a goshawk called Mabel. Such was the success of the book that it's been made into a movie starring Claire Foy as Helen and Brendan Gleeson as Helen's father. You may have seen the posters if you live in London, they're all over the tube, and the film opens on Friday. So it's a very exciting time to be talking to you, Helen MacDonald, and a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you. What a joy it is to see you again. I think you interviewed me about 10 years ago when I was a sort of bewildered, dissociated wreck after the book sort of started doing really well. And now I'm just a bewildered, dissociated, older wreck. Now the film's coming out.
So it is really nice to see you again. It was actually 11 years ago, can you believe it?
Amazing.
In Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you were a professor still at Jesus.
Yeah.
And I remember we walked down to the University Press and looked at peregrine falcons nesting.
We did, and they are still nesting in Cambridge. There are significantly fewer pigeons in Cambridge than there used to be, and tourists still get bits of dead pigeon raining down on their heads from their falcons. It's all very red in tooth and claw still, yeah.
Well, I know this is a very oldie thing to say, but I would have said it was about 3 years ago, but it was 11 years ago. Tell me, there's been masses of change since then, so just start at the beginning. What's happened since that time?
Well, you know, so much has happened. Oh my goodness. I did lots of touring with the book. That was really interesting. I mean, that's something they don't tell writers, or maybe writers are supposed to know, is that if your book does well, then suddenly you stop being this, you know, quiet, hermetic, you know, quiet person who never wants to see anyone and hides under the desk and weeps. And you have to go out and be very sociable and meet people and do basically little one-man shows, which I did for, you know, 2 or 3 years. And that was enormously important to me in the sense that a lot of people who'd read the book came up to me and wanted to talk about their own losses and griefs and hardships and sadnesses. And it was like the book kind of gave them an excuse to do that and to talk about with a stranger, really, and that they felt they knew. And that was really intense, you know, losses of a magnitude so much greater than mine. And I had to listen to them all, which I did with great, it was a very solemn thing to do. And it's made me a much softer person, you know, after that, realizing that we all go through it. We all have these terrible, terrible times. And if we don't when we're in our 30s, we will by the time we hit our 50s. So that happened. I've now got 3 parrots rather than hawks. I've got 2 little conures called Bucky and Uwu, and a green Amazon parrot called Bertie. Actually, Sir Bertilac, but Bertie for short. He's the Green Knight. Oh God, listen to me. You can tell I did English at Cambridge. How embarrassing! And life is good.
I'm starting to laugh.
We had to do Gawain, which we loved. So life's good. I mean, I'm on my own with my parrots. I'm very eccentric. I take my parrots for walks around the village. My village is full of eccentrics because it's Suffolk, and all Suffolk villages are. It's full of wonderful people. Life's good, yeah. But now there's a film about me, which I for ages thought wasn't weird. It's like, oh, it's fine. It's just, but it is. It's actually really weird.
I can't wait to talk to you about the film because there's so many things in there that are rather different from the book or from what I remember of the book. But can we pause and go back a bit? Because I'd love you to tell our listeners a bit about your upbringing, just a little bit, and about your beloved father, Alistair MacDonald, who was a photographer for the Sunday Mirror.
He was I think he was the youngest photographer ever employed in Fleet Street. Yeah, he was like 16 or something when they took him on. He was just a preternaturally good photographer. My upbringing. Again, it was one of those things that, you know, I think our family is pretty neurodivergent. I think we've realised in the last few years, like many people. And, you know, we all thought we were normal growing up. But looking back on it, I had a very far from normal childhood. So me, my mum and dad and my brother, we grew up in a place called Teckles Park in Camberley, which was, they were journalists and photojournalists. And we grew up on this place that was an old country estate that had been bought by the Theosophical Society, which is that wonderful 19th century esoteric kind of society. So we were surrounded by wonderfully eccentric old ladies, basically. There was an esoteric society. There were people who were in the SOE during the war. There was a woman who had a great orc egg in a drawer. There was, just luminously, wondrously eccentric people. And I loved them all and had no idea that this was an unusual place to grow up as a sort of, as a child. And I think they gave me this sort of very early education in that you don't have to accept the stories that the world tells you about how you have to behave. You can basically just be yourself. And I have been terrifyingly myself ever since. No prisoners. So I grew up there and my brother and I had a lot of fun growing up. We ran free, we ran wild around this sort of great big estate. And, we grew up in Camberley in the 80s, which was, sort of yuppie heaven. I remember there was a huge outcry when McDonald's came to town, to this sort of Victorian army town. But yeah, that was it. Then I went to Cambridge and then I left Cambridge and bred falcons for the royal family in Abu Dhabi, as you do, because that's what you do after an English degree. So I did that and worked in conservation and bird of prey conservation in the Gulf States, and then came back and started a PhD in the history of science that I never finished because I have raging ADHD and I'm very bad at finishing anything. And then wrote the book after my dad died, which was a great shock.
And what did you do, just before we get on to the film, immediately after that book? Because what I hadn't realised from watching the film, which didn't come out in the book so much, and certainly didn't come out when we were chatting at Cambridge, I hadn't realised how much you were dying to get out of academia.
Yeah, I loved research. I am genuinely my happiest when I'm in a library. Oh, mind you, hawks are also kind of really cool. Trying to kind of bridge that divide between the active and the contemplative life was a kind of real medieval kind of tussle, and I kind of lived that, It's like, I want to be flying hawks, but I also want to sit in a library and read manuscripts.
And you can't take the hawk into the library.
Well, you can't these days. I probably could back then. But, I already knew that I'd come back to university. I was a lot older than a lot of my compatriots or my colleagues. And I kept, working on these. I was working in the history of science and the history of animal behaviour and all kinds of things that I'm just fascinating examples and fascinating kind of analyses. And I realised that no one outside the university would ever hear about any of this. It was all going to be stuck in the university. And I just felt really strongly that I wanted to write for everybody. Mm. So already at that point, I felt, And also, basically a state school kid who went to university, and I still, even then, this was 2007, I still felt a little bit like I didn't belong.
That's so interesting.
No matter how friendly and welcoming my college was, I still felt, I wasn't quite up to snuff, I wasn't quite posh enough, which is very strange and very internalised feeling, I think. So one of the things that was really funny after I started touring with the book was I would go up and do these talks, and I'd be absolutely terrified, because of course all my experience at Cambridge was that when you give a talk, your audience is going to try and take you down. And no, they just wanted to hear what I wanted to say, which was like, what?
It's because it's a very good scene in the film if you've been taken down, isn't there, by somebody who suggests you're absolutely vile and cruel and revolting and wanting to kill animals because your hawk attacks, well, Mabel attacks the rabbit.
Yeah, the hunting stuff's really interesting, so yeah. I didn't know how much the film would get into that. And, my take on it is that, I'm not a particularly bloodthirsty person, but if you keep a hawk, that's what hawks do. Mm. So that's what I did with Mabel, and it became a very kind of Stone Age feral existence. But yes, that's not entirely fictive, but that scene was very much a bunch of people, different people said things like that to me over that year, and I think, it was good to put them in the voice of one very angry person, and then watch. It's an incredible scene. Claire basically just sort of loses it in this deeply controlled and British manner, and then completely loses it, and she is astonishing in that role.
She is. So let's get on to the film.
Yeah.
How did it all come about? I mean, it's a pretty big deal. You've got Brad Pitt alongside.
Yes, I'm an executive producer with Brad Pitt. What? I grew up in Camberley.
I mean, what happened? How did it? Who approached whom?
So it's been quite a long process. So early on, the film was optioned very quickly after it was published by Lena Headey from Game of Thrones fame, who really loved the book. And then she teamed up with the extraordinary Dee Dee Gardner at Plan B, who is one of those legendary Hollywood people that, you know, kind of, she's just terrifying and brilliant and lovely and incredibly clever. And her and Jeremy Kleiner will basically produce this film. But it took a long time to come to fruition. We got Emma Donoghue in as the screenwriter.
Who wrote Room.
Who wrote Room.
And you wrote it with her, didn't you?
I didn't. I initially, they asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said no. I really don't want to do any of the screenplay. And I felt really strongly about that. It's like, you know, I wrote my story, and now someone else can take that story and make their own story of it. Because, you know, being a good English student, you know, who, no one owns narrative. It exists in the telling, so... But I did help a little bit. So Philippa, who also did a lot of work on the script.
The director, Philippa Lothorpe,
who's amazing and did the incredible series called Three Girls many years ago, which is how I knew of her. A documentarian filmmaker. And that's her kind of... She does this incredible kind of hybrid...
She does gritty films
that are kind of... about real people, which is an extraordinary gift to be able to do that. And she's a perfect
match. She did the one about Miss World, didn't she?
So she came to me at the end of the process of, you know, so we finessed some of the stuff in the script together. Is that the right word? It sounds a bit kind of wanky, doesn't it? But we, some of the stuff we put in there, yeah, together. But it wasn't my baby, this film. This was, you know, Philippa's and Dee's and Claire's. And, you know, it was one of the funniest things that happened. I might be forestalling you a bit here, but Philippa said, you know, Claire wants to speak to you before we start filming. And I'm like, absolutely. Because there's a lot of me on the internet, so she could watch me and, you know. So suddenly I was faced on this Zoom screen by this person who just looked like me and had my mannerisms and talked like me and had my hair. And basically I was like, I was talking to her and thinking to myself, my God, it's amazing. Claire is just like me. And then after about, you know, a few minutes, I realised that actually she was acting really, really flawlessly. And in fact, she was just, yeah, finessing her.
It's quite interesting because I read Philippa Lothorpe had said that she was absolutely blown away by how Claire managed to inhabit you. And she burst into tears when she first saw her stomping along with the...
Because I've got one leg longer than the other. It was all had this slightly weird, lopey kind of walk. And Claire had just... got my walk and yeah, I mean, there was this, you know, I've said to a few people that the first time I saw her in the flesh, as it were, as me, just such a weird sentence to come out with, was in my old college, Jesus. So I turned the corner and there was Claire dressed as me, wearing my clothes, with a hawk on her gloved fist, walking down through the cloisters.
That's the first time you met her in the flesh.
It's the first time I met her in the flesh. And the thing that I remember most vividly there is my brain going, "What? That's me. That's me in 2007." And I felt like a ghost. I felt like a ghost watching myself. And I had to put my hand out to the brick at the side of me and just to touch it to feel something real. And it wasn't even just the fact that she was walking like me and looked like me. It was that the space between her and the hawk was charged with exactly that bizarre combination of love and care and sort of mutual incomprehension and trust.
Mystery.
Mm. That, you know, because it turns out, luckily, that Claire is an astonishingly good intuitive falconer. And without that, I don't think this film would have been anywhere near as extraordinary as it is. And I think partly it's, you know, she'd never done falconry before the film. She had 2 weeks tuition with Lloyd and Rose Buck, who supplied the hawks for the film. And I think there's something about being an actor and being able to register the most infinitesimally small micro-expressions and non-verbal cues and read them and know what they mean that means that, you know, you can be a falconer. Because it's all about reading these incredibly slight non-verbal cues and the hawk's posture and what it's doing with its feathers and stuff like that. She's an incredible falconer. It's amazing.
But the hawk was a star in its own right.
Well, there are actually more than one hawk.
Yes, that's
there's
what
a few
I remember.
Hawks.
Yes.
Yeah, we had this whole selection. It's like... So there were... Yeah, so the hawks were... I cannot tell you how worried I was. That was the thing. I didn't want to do the script, but I wanted to make sure the falconry was done right. Because, you know, we're talking about this 5,000-year-old relationship between humans and hawks. And hawks have never been domesticated. So every time, as you know, we've talked about this before, that every time a new hawk is hatched and is, you know, has to be tamed from scratch and persuaded that humans are not evil. So the whole of the shoot was all about keeping the hawks happy, to the point where no one could wear bright colours. Most people were not in, it was like a closed, like, I always think it's a bit like, you know, kind of a, you know, I mean, I laugh about this now, it's a bit like a kind of porn shoot. It was a closed shoot, you know? And then the hawks had, like, very few people around. Everyone had to be very quiet. We had to hide the fluffy sound booms because, of course, the hawks would be either scared by them or want to attack them. So it was a film made under, as far as I can see, like, conditions. It's an extremely tough film to make because the hawks had to be happy.
Yeah.
And Claire had to fit everything. And, of course, but of course that's what I had to do when I was training the hawks. So it's worked really well. It's an astonishing movie. I know I'm biased a bit because it's about me, but it really is astonishing.
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
I really do. Well,
and what about your father's presentation by Brendan Gleeson?
Oh, man. You know, it's funny, looking at the film now, it's so clearly a film about a very neurodivergent father and daughter, you know, like bonding and understanding each other in a way.
Lovely relationship.
But so much love there, and Claire and Brendan just capture that perfectly. And I met Brendan on set, and it was this extraordinary moment. He got out of a taxi or a van that had come to bring him to the set, and he was wearing, you know, obviously... He said to me, "Oh, hello," and he looked very concerned, and he kind of furrowed his brow, and he said, "I must be very weird seeing me wearing your father's clothes." And there was such concern and kind of compassion and love in his voice that my heart just contracted, and I gave him a big hug and said, "Hello, film dad." He's astonishing. He's physically not like my dad, but he completely captures that sort of very unreconstructed masculinity, kind of married with a very deep softness and generosity, which is a kind of unusual, I think, unusually accurate to how my father was. Yeah,
it's interesting because in the film, the sort of turning point is the address you give at his funeral.
Yeah,
when you understand how much he embraced life, and that's what you'd stop.
Yeah,
fearing.
I'd run away from it.
You'd run away from
embrace,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you think is that true? Is that actually what happened in real life?
Yeah,
was it?
Yeah, I remember. Mm. Standing there, already knowing that I was kind of broken and depressed because, you know, this isn't a story, as anyone who's read the book knows, it's not a story like I was sad and I got a hawk and the hawk made me better. It's
no,
way more complicated
not at all.
than that. The hawk basically took me to a very dark place. I wanted to be a hawk. I wanted to be this goshawk full of rage and sort of blood and grief and kind of big emotions. But yeah, standing there, I realised that I had lost sight of the fact that everyone in that church loved Dad and missed him. And for their own personal reasons, and they knew a different person. But I remember just thinking this line, which is in the book, you know, human hands are for other human hands to hold. They should not be reserved exclusively as purchase for hawks, you know. And I knew at that point that I had to come back.
Tell me a bit about your best friend, Christina, because I don't remember her so well from the book.
Yeah.
She's brilliantly played by Denise Goff.
Oh,
and
she's
how
amazing.
Lucky were you to have... I mean, is she like that in real life? Because what a friend to have.
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, one of the things that the film does... Also, I keep saying one of the things, there's millions of things the film does, but it gets across the extraordinary power of a proper friendship.
Yes.
So the film's, I think, about love in all kinds of different kinds of loves. And, you know, the love of the non-human and the love of dads and mothers and families and brothers and, you know, love of landscape. But also the love of a good friendship. And Christina's been my best friend for 25 years. She's this extraordinarily brainy philosopher from Australia, from Melbourne. And she's beautifully portrayed by Denise Goff, who played this amazing villain in Andor, the Star Wars series.
And she did that amazing play on stage, and People, Places and Things.
Yeah, she's an incredible,
actress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's at the moment, she's in...
She's
doing High Noon, I think.
Yeah, High Noon, that's exactly what
she's
doing.
Yeah, which is very exciting. But yeah, she's also very, very funny, as Christina is. So one of the things that's lovely about this way she portrays Christina is that there are these moments of such love and lightness in the midst of this dreadful despair. And towards the end, I'm giving a sort of, I hope it's not too bad of a bit of a spoiler, but there's a point where Christina can see how broken Helen is.
Yes.
And doesn't try and fix her. It just becomes very plain that she's like, this is something that Helen has to go through, but I am here as her friend while she does that. And I think that's like, there's no greater sign of deep friendship than knowing that when to let someone have this emotional response, but also make them know that you're there if if they need you.
There's a very good moment when she comes into the room and she offers to, she sees the chaos, but unlike your family who visit and are horrified by it, she sees it, she clocks it, and she just goes, "When you, obviously you've got to write your father's funeral address,
yeah, exactly.
But you're also about to be chucked out of your house, so I'll pack," she says.
Yeah.
And there's no judgment.
It's the
judgment.
Lack of judgment, yeah. I think, that's, you know. Mm. And, of course, the judgment of my family in the film was born of love.
Yes,
but of course. That's a familial judgment that, you know, Helen's broken, we need to fix him.
Is your mother still alive?
Yeah, she is, yeah. She really liked the film.
Did she?
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and we had a screening. And what's lovely, particularly lovely, is that a lot of the things in the film, a lot of the actual props, were real. So the cameras that Brendan uses were my dad's cameras. There's a lot of stuff on the mantelpiece in Helen's house in the film that the set is kind of bits, you know, bird skulls and feathers from my real house.
The tiger jaw, was that? Is that
no, your... that's not mine. I would love to have it. I'd love to have a saber-tooth tiger jaw. My goodness. But and also the Hawking waistcoat that Claire wears, that was the real waistcoat that I wore when I flew Mabel. So it's like a kind of film that's made of, you know, sort of bricolage of real and story.
It's quite interesting, the film, because it's presenting itself as being an adaptation of your novel, but it wasn't a novel. I didn't read H's for Hawk as a novel.
It was a non-fiction memoir, but there was a lot of, I mean, there was a kind of dramatised biography of the writer T.H. White.
Yes,
so
yes.
And that didn't fit in the film.
No, because, it didn't, no.
You know, I think, you know, when he was a very, very complicated and difficult character, and I think if you try to portray him in a movie without having someone to explain why he was doing the terrible things he was doing, he would just come across as an absolutely unmitigated monster. So I think it was a very good thing that Emma Donoghue did early on, which was to turn it into a sort of drama about family and love and loss rather than make it a literary story.
Yes, I don't see why he would have fitted in.
No.
And also, at the end of your book, you say goodbye to T.H. White,
yeah.
And you've so done him. I mean, you've done the absolute definitive study of him, really.
Well, he still haunts me a little bit, and there's been some lovely things that have happened since, you know, that I've discovered that the Goshawk, this extraordinary book he wrote in about trying to train a goshawk in the 1930s and did this terrible job, but it's an incredible book, agonising book. It's been translated into new languages because of H is for Hawk, which is such an extraordinary thing. I feel like, you know, I've done something, I don't know, that's a kind of special thing, that more people have read it because of my book.
So now,
yes,
you're living in Suffolk with three parrots.
Oh, no, yes.
And what next? I mean, what
well, I mean, I'm still writing a big book on Midway Atoll, Albatrosses and the End of the World. So that's a really fun book I'm doing. And it was meant to be out. Well, it was meant to be out years ago, but unfortunately the pandemic meant that I couldn't go to a remote Pacific island to research it. So I stayed at home and I wrote a giant gay sci-fi romance thriller with a friend, which was really fun to do. No one expected that. That's called Prophet, and it was so much fun. I've never had as much fun writing in my life. It was just the sort of thing built out of all the genre stuff that I love loved as a kid. And my co-writer, Sin Blaché, is this incredible American-Irish writer, and we just had more fun with it. So that was great fun. But now I'm back on Midway, which is it's a book about this tiny, tiny speck of land in the Pacific that used to be a naval air station and has got the ruins of this US naval air station still on it. But also, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of albatrosses that just sit there on their eggs, some of which are up to sort of 70 years old, possibly longer, and they've seen a lot of things happen. So it's a book about that.
Because, of course, albatrosses, obviously, as we're both, you know, boring old English graduates.
Guilt.
And they have, of course, this great literary resonance.
Yeah, Baudelaire,
Coleridge, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they've represented guilt and, you know... And they haven't, you know, there's an extraordinary amount of, you know, worry about them. You know, they pick up plastic trash in the ocean and they feed it to their young by mistake, basically. And, you know, there's this whole kind of sense of environmental guilt and, you know, what we do with that. And so it's a really interesting story. But hopefully there'll be jokes in it as well. It's not going to be all miserable because I'm not a miserable person. You can't afford to be. Even in the face of all that's going on right now, you have to really try hard to be hopeful. Or at least have a laugh sometimes.
And you have been to the depths. I mean, you were really unhappy at that point, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, I was deeply, deeply depressed. You know, and people meet me now and they're... Well, I still wear black all the time, but people meet me and they're like, oh, you're really cheerful. I'm like, oh, yes, I lost my dad. I was broken, but I'm quite an optimistic person at heart, so, yeah.
So, are you touring with the film?
I'm off to Bath tomorrow. So we're going to do the Bath Festival, and then I'm going to Marlborough, one of my favourite towns in Wiltshire, because my mum and dad and I used to drive through it. We used to have tea in Polly's Tea Rooms, which has been there for... So I'm going to do a showing in Marlborough, I think, on the 6th of February. And it's coming out at the same time in America, too, but I'm too busy here to go to America at this point, unfortunately. But I'm doing lots of virtual stuff, so it's a real thrill. It's a real thrill to sort of celebrate this beautiful thing that I didn't make, but reflects something I made. It's like my story, but in a universe one half step to one side of this one, and it's really special.
It sounds like they've done it absolutely... brilliant job. I mean, is there anything you're unhappy with about it, or that you look at it and you think, oh no, that would never have happened? Or
there is one thing, and I feel that you feel terrible saying this, but there is a scene towards the end. It's a devastatingly wonderful scene, but in that scene Brendan Gleeson raises a camera and it's not a Nikon, and my dad would have been terribly upset by that. What? But yeah, no, I mean, I don't have any complaints. I don't think I've ever heard anything so
harmonious about a film before that's based on someone's real life.
No, I know. You'd have thought I'd be kicking off, wouldn't you? But it's just been done with such love and such care. And in fact, even when I visited the set, I remember everyone felt the same about this project. And even I remember meeting a security guard. He didn't know who I was, so I could have been anyone. And he was talking to me about how... He said, I've only had my first day on the job, and, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. And I thought, you don't tell me this. And he said, but I've always wanted to see a hawk up close. And he was practically tearful about this. It was magical. It's a magical thing.
Has Falconry taken off, do you think, more? Because there's a lot of it. I remember when you and I talked all those years ago, I was amazed to find out how many Falconry centres...
There's quite a few around. I mean, I don't think anything that I've done has made it more popular. I mean, there have been a few people I've spoken to who have read the book and suddenly realised that deep down that's what they always meant to be, which, you know, that's how Falconry grips you. And I remember when I was in the middle, when I worked in the Gulf States, you know, I remember Aaron Falconer saying to me that, you know, Allah chooses who's going to be, God chooses who's going to be a Falconer, and, you know, that's just how it is. You just, that's your thing. You can't do anything about it. You might not be a Falconer, but that's your loss, because you would have been a good one. And it's like that. People have read the book and thought, oh, I need to be a Falconer. But I think I made Goshawks look hard enough that no one wants to...
No, it didn't look easy.
It's not like... Because there was a terrible sort of problem after Cares, apparently. Everyone wanted to have a Kestrel after that extraordinary...
Ken Loach's film
came out. But luckily, no one wants a Goshawk, which is very, very pleasing to me.
It was actually... one thing I will say, it was a lot less bloody, the film, than the book.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't go in.
I mean, there are hunting scenes, but they're all CGI. So, you know, you have these extraordinary moments where hawks are chasing animals. And these amazing shots, because Philippa was like, you know, told all the cameramen, I don't want it to look like a nature documentary. It's got to look raw and fast and like your heart is caught up with a bird. And they were training these birds to fly with drones, which is amazing, you know. And then they would have shots of rabbits running. And then they would, like, CGI the hawk catching the rabbit. Very well, I must say.
Very well done.
So no animals were harmed during the making of this film.
And would you ever have a goshawk again?
You know, I don't know. I used to feel very comfortable about saying stuff like, oh, I don't ever want to do X again, or don't ever want to do Y again. And I remember, you know, I think I've reached the age now where I've realised that, you know, how you feel about life and how you feel about what you want to do can change overnight, so never say never.
Speaking like a true oldie, if I may say that.
Yeah, you can't tell, can you?
Whatever,
that's the way to do it.
I think that was that's a great place to end. Helen McDonald, thank you so much for being on Radio Aldi. What a delight to catch up with you. And everybody, the film is fantastic. Go and see it.
No, it's been a joy. Thank you so much, everyone.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, talking to the writer Helen McDonald. If you've enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks to you again, Helen McDonald, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.